Welcome back to This Has to Work. Today, Nate Schmidt is joining me. Nate is a founder, investor, mentor, and board member, and is currently the Director of Portfolio Success at High Alpha Innovation, an organization that partners with corporations, universities, and startups to launch meaningful solutions to important market problems. Nate is one of the OGs of the Birmingham startup community, and prior to joining High Alpha, he founded Instagift, launched the Innovation Depot's Velocity Accelerator, and then launched and managed the Techstars Energy Accelerator in Alabama. Welcome to the show, Nate.
It's a great honor. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're going to get into the whole OG status a little bit later to kind of qualify that, but I think anybody who knows you probably already understands that. Did I miss any of the major milestones in that introduction?
No, look, startup founder, startup supporter, and now working on the venture side. So I think you got it.
Yeah. So let's start with High Alpha. I think this is an incredibly interesting model, the way that this works. So that approach, let me take a step back. I want to talk a little bit about venture studios in case anybody listening to this, you know, all 23 people, have any idea what a venture studio is. But typically a venture studio is you have a group of experienced individuals that find an idea from a founder or a piece of technology from a founder. They don't want to grow it, right? They're not in the position. Maybe they're not interested. Maybe they're not capable of doing it. There's some sort of licensing deal or some sort of partnership that's struck. And then the venture studio goes out and finds people basically to run it, take it to the next thing, make it maybe investable or more valuable or whatever the case may be. High Alpha, when I first looked at it, I go, well, that's a venture studio. And you and I had a conversation about it. You corrected me on that. Talk a little bit about how that model works, because it feels like that, but it isn't at all. It's very unique.
Yeah, I would maybe say that your characterization of studios in general, I would expand that definition a little bit. You know, if you and I decide to go start a new company tomorrow, you can quit your podcasting and VC gig. I can stop working at High Alpha Innovation. We can go start our own company. Those companies statistically are likely to fail. It's a huge amount of risk. And so, and traditionally, that's how startups work, is that somebody has an idea, you go start a company. And usually you don't vet it out as much as you should. You're excited to build something, so you go build it. That describes me. I was interested in restaurants coming out of law school, so I started a dining guide for restaurants. Like, I like food. I'm going to start a restaurant website. That's what described me. But if you think about who can start those companies, you have to be able to take on a lot of risk. And what I mean by risk is you have to be able to afford to live with no salary for a long period of time. And so who can take that risk? Young people. Who can't take that risk? People like you or I that have high schoolers. And so, you know, when I think about labs, I think about it as a new way to start a company. And the biggest definition for me of a lab is you kind of decouple the idea from the entrepreneur. And so in our case, and there's a million different flavors of these labs, and you kind of described, you know, a few of them. In our case, we will not launch a company unless we have a corporate partner attached. And so what we do is we head out into the world. There's about 50 people in the company, and we go to corporates and universities. And the central thesis of our organization is that big corporates and big universities should not be doing internal innovation. They're going to screw it up.
Yeah.
And so with that as the foundation, we will go in and we'll say, look, you're going to mess it up. We know what we're doing. Let us run a process for you where we identify issues in the company that that would be best be served by a new venture. And if we can find something that is worth launching a new startup, you're going to fund it. So you're going to pay us a little bit to do the analysis. And then if we find a startup, your first investor, corporate, university, your first investor, $1 million for 20% of the company, a standard initial investment. Then we have a talent team. So now we have an idea. We have a funded idea. We also tell that corporate or university they're going to be first customer. And then we head out into the world, and our talent team finds the entrepreneurs. And then when these companies launch, it gets handed off to my side of the house, which is who loves on these companies, supports these companies, does the accelerator work that I've been doing for a very long time. But if you think about this company versus, you know, you and I starting a new one in our basement, these founders come in and they have real salaries, real six-figure salaries. They have money to deploy. They have an initial customer. They have all this support from High Alpha Innovation and from our partners. So it's a different way to launch a company. And it comes with, you know, you don't get as much of the cap table, but the founders still get a majority of the cap table and look and feel like an investable startup that, you know, someone like Futures Fund or Red Hawk might be willing to take a look at.
Yeah. Talking to you, you mentioned a little bit about your role. But this really does feel kind of custom built for you. And what I mean custom built for you, that's unfair. But what I'm saying is, like, everything that you've been doing and the things that you've really leaned into in your career, not just as a founder, because you were very supportive of your peers, and we'll talk a little bit about that in a second, but you've always been a big community supporter. I mean, with Velocity, I joke around, or I don't joke around, but I always mention that, like, you and your dad literally were, like, hammering nails and screwing in screws, like, physically building out that space. Like, this is part of your DNA. So going into this role at High Alpha, where it's about portfolio success, seems really custom built. But talk a little bit more about what that means to you and the kind of work you're doing with those companies.
Yeah, helping really early stage companies is delightful for a variety of reasons. You can find yourself, you get to get in the weeds, you get to build. And I have that, you know, I need to scratch that itch. I'm a builder through and through. And so you get to be very tactical with companies and think about how they're going to develop the business and how they're going to develop the software and how they're going to run sales funnels and how they're going to raise money. All of those moves are important. But if you're supporting early stage startups, it's all about the soft skills too. It's about availability. It's about optimism. You know, I argue, or I tell people that I would say that 80% of what I do as a founder will come to me and they'll be like, Nate, I want to go do this thing. And I'm like, just do it.
Yeah.
Like, just cheering founders on in a really, in a competent way is a big part of my job. But I'll find myself dealing with being a shoulder to cry on 1 minute, have a founder come to me and like, I don't understand what's happening here. Can you explain it to me? And then find myself in an incredibly consequential biz dev conversation the next. And so it runs the gamut and it's a blast and I enjoy it.
And also too, I want to highlight this because you were one of the first people that I heard talk about things around mental health for founders and how important that is. And not just important to them, but important to everyone around them to recognize that, support that, to encourage them to get help if they need to get help, or at least acknowledge that they're struggling. And I hadn't heard a lot of people talk about that. And I'm quite sure that is always in the back of your mind. So it's not just about having biz dev conversations, not just about, hey, here's how you need to look at your cap table. This is how you need to look at X, Y, and Z. It's also like, hey, how are you doing? You doing okay? How are you balancing all of this? This is stressful. Like, you just had a key employee quit. Like, how do you feel about that? Is that something that's always still front of mind for you?
Yeah, 100%. You know, in thinking about my own mental health as a founder, being a founder can be, it's certainly stressful. It's not a 9-to-5. It's isolating. Like, take my first example. We go start a business in our basement tomorrow and we give up good paying jobs and we're talented people. All of a sudden, we're alone.
Well, you're talented. I'm just along for the ride.
I'll co-found a business with you any day. How about that?
I'm just happy to be there.
In fact, let's just drop it now and go to our basements and
all right,
and
we're
a company.
Done. Yeah. There
you go. No, look, it's really stressful and it's a unique job and usually you're irrationally optimistic about your chances. Like, you're doing something that's probably going to fail, and no matter how many times someone like you or I fails at something, it comes as a total surprise to us. You can tell me, like, Nate, that thing is going to fail. And I'm like, yeah, I'm still doing it anyway. That describes the entrepreneurial experience. And then when it fails, I'm like, oh my gosh, I never would have guessed it would have been me. And you would have been like, I would have totally guessed it would have been you. Statistically, it's going to be you. So we do. We have to keep a real eye on how we take care of ourselves. This job comes with a lot of empathy attached. And I think I've been good at that over the years.
So you have spent time in a bunch of different markets, verticals, however you want to classify that. And one of the things at High Alpha that you're now spending some time on, and something that we actually share an affinity for, I'm just starting to really understand it. I think you're, let's say, knee deep in it at this point. But one of those things is ag tech. And it to me, and you and I have had this conversation, it's something that we don't pay enough attention to. And there's some fascinating things going on in that space. So for our listeners, what is or how would you define ag tech, and why should people be paying more attention to it?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of in the name. It's bringing new technologies to the world of agriculture. I care a lot about it too. I think, well, first of all, I grew up in small town Kansas, and my dad grew up a Mennonite farmer. He was one of five kids, and he was the youngest. He hated it. Absolutely hated the farm, and he decided when he was young that he was going to do whatever the opposite of being a Mennonite farmer was. So he became a tax attorney. So, you know, my lineage is I grew up going to the farm all the time, got to see that side of the world, and then, you know, got the tax attorney side too. And then I ended up an entrepreneur. So I feel like I'm getting back to my roots a little bit. One thing I didn't mention about High Alpha Innovation is our model is we will go to a university or corporate and we'll say, let's do one company. And if you like it, let's do another company. And if you like that, why don't you start your own lab and we'll kind of be the operating system behind the lab. And so we have our first one of those with Purdue University, which spun up an entire fund to take on new ag tech projects called Dial Ventures. And we've launched our first 5 ag tech companies out of that and hope to launch many more. But look, food is important, and we're about to hit 8 billion people on the planet. And the way that we've grown food has changed significantly with climate change and a million other factors. And so how are we going to, this is existential stuff. That's why the work that we're doing is so interesting, because we're solving the world's biggest problems. And what bigger problem is than, putting food in our mouth? So I'm incredibly pleased to see that our growing vertical at High Alpha Innovations AgTech, and to get to kind of reimmerse myself in my farming roots has been a blast.
Yeah, you mentioned something that's kind of a systemic or structural issue with agriculture in the United States, which is succession planning within a family. Oftentimes, I read some statistic where it's like low single digits, the percentage of kids that follow their parents into dairy farming specifically, because for those out there that don't know, dairy farmers don't get vacations. They are dairy farmers 365 days of the year. There are no breaks for them, and it's an incredibly tedious operation. And so just the basics of continuing a farming operation, a dairy operation, an agricultural operation is not a foregone conclusion anymore. So just basic sustainability or repeatability is at stake here.
It's worse than you're even letting on, which is, yes, of course, getting the kids to come do the work of the parents is difficult. Over close to half the farms in the United States are not owned by the farmers. They're owned by landowners, and you lease from these landowners. But it's worse than that. Oftentimes, a farm will have 10 to 100 individual landowners. They're managing all of those leases. They're dealing with all of those individuals. And that level is experiencing the same thing. The landowners are dying. The kids are inheriting the land. And then the kids are like, I just want to sell. I just want the money. And so on multiple levels, we're dealing with this succession issue. And we invested in a company that's taking on this exact problem called Oaken. Oaken.ag, and they're dealing with the succession problem in agriculture, both on multiple levels. So yeah, you pointed out a big one. Just simply, who's going to do the work, and how are they going to get access to the land to do the work? Those are real problems.
Yeah, and I'll save everybody else from nerding out on the whole idea of, like, you no longer even buy seed, you license seed, and all of the things that come with that. Again, I'll save our listeners from that. But if you're interested in that, look into it, because it's fascinating and potentially horrifying simultaneously. So I referred to you as one of the Birmingham kind of OGs, so kind of the original gangsters of the startup ecosystem. Specifically, you were among some of the earliest kind of what I would call tech 2.0. So founders that were really tech forward, natively digital, going either B2B or B2C, software-based, technology heavy. And at one point in time, you were actually office neighbors, if I remember this correctly, and get my, if my facts are off, correct me, but you were basically neighbors with Segun Ogunlanna, Jonathan Robinson, and Tony Somerville. So if those names don't mean anything to you, look them up. They should. I would also put them in that kind of category of OGs, and I've gotten to know each of them a little bit. What was it like to be part of that startup scene at that point in time? In what was kind of seemingly brand new, like when you were walking around, I think you've shared, stories with me where you were trying to explain what InstaGift did and people just scratched their heads because they couldn't wrap their head around it.
Yeah, that's right. InstaGift, Fleetio, Theranest, and Free Textbooks. We were all neighbors in the back hall at Innovation Depot. And, you don't know any different. Like, we were out there having a good time. Now that when you look back, who would have ever guessed that, two of those companies would, equal multiple billions of dollars? That's incredibly extraordinary. But it was a good time. We were out there building our companies. I've got a million stories, and I don't know, I'm not going to bore you with story after story of those days. But we were very entrepreneurial. We were collaborative. Our staffs all knew each other and would hang out. And I think one thing that has always really stuck with me as I have looked back on that time is that, and no, we never had this conversation. We were all just wired this way. All of us were wired to give back. Tony Somerville 15 years ago started Startup Drinks, and he had ran multiple tech conferences here. Shagan, both now and after his exit, is, you know, one of the biggest supporters of startups and has his own lab where he's spinning out his next wave of companies. Jonathan Robinson just built a bookstore in Homewood that's like one of the centers of our community. And, you know, I've done what I've done. So it was this really cool time, but you have to have the startup founders giving back. And I think I hope that's a big part of our legacy from all those years ago.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that. One funny story from that was Jonathan Robinson was running freetextbooks.com. And at one point in time, an entire shelf basically went through the wall of the depot. Were you still in the office when all that went down? Because it was kind of a mini disaster.
Oh, it was one of my favorite moments. They had probably a 1,500, 2,000 square foot space that was floor to ceiling, rack after rack after rack after rack of textbooks. There were probably, I don't know, 50 racks of textbooks. And they just had one little desk like hidden in the corner. And one day, it started at the back. It wasn't one that fell. They all fell.
It was like a domino.
It was a domino. And when the last one hit, it went against the wall. It went through the wall and the book spilled out into the hallway. And yeah, we all heard it. And we walked out. And I still remember there were folks there at the depot that were like, leadership that was mad.
Yeah, right.
And I was like, this is the greatest, one of the greatest moments in the history of our startup ecosystem, that this company got so big that they literally busted out into the hallway. Like, that's the good stuff.
Yeah, your perception of this or perspective on this is just wrong. You should be like, this is great. They're literally bursting through the walls.
Well, now, I mean, what great content.
Yeah, right,
like,
right.
Let's capture this immediately, not like go get the brooms and start cleaning up. Like, let's tell this story.
Well, and it's funny, too, because, I mean, talk about coming full circle. So now Jonathan and his team have launched Little Professor. And in true kind of Jonathan Robinson style, like, he has a tech component to it, and a tech component that potentially is beyond just Little Professor and all those things. So if you're ever in Homewood, Alabama, and get the chance, go and see those guys at Little Professor. It's a great place, and your kids will love it. So you formally added kind of mentor to your resume and community builder when you launched Velocity. And I alluded to this earlier, and I do share this story because I think, to your point, the imagery of you and Estes and Brooke and your father and other people literally hammering nails and screwing in screws and figuring out how to build a space that doesn't have a budget, that doesn't have a lot of support. It was a build it and we hope it works kind of scenario. And it's all the things that I think that you and I think a lot of people get excited about, you know, true startup fashion. Did you have any idea that was going to end up being so seminal for the ecosystem? Because I really do believe, and I'm not just saying this because you're sitting in front of me and we're recording this and then sharing it with people. I really do believe that had Velocity not happened, I don't think it really would have opened the doors for things that have happened since then. So do you ever give yourself an opportunity to look back and like say, hey, that really had a huge impact? And did you have any idea that it was going to be like that, that it was going to have that impact when you guys were literally building it?
No. Look, the answer is no. Full disclosure, my company was failing at the time. And I had just gone through a breakup with my co-founder, and I really enjoyed being at Innovation Depot. I didn't love everything about it. I thought there were some things that could be improved, but I wanted to stay. And I had that back hallway experience that, you know, that we just talked about. But I didn't want to go anywhere, but my company was failing. So what was I going to do? Well, we decided to launch Velocity, and part of the vision was, I went through Techstars in 2010, and so I had this experience where I got to see what a mature ecosystem and a top-level accelerator was. So let's try to bring that to Alabama. There was also a vision of, let's build the depot that we wish existed. And so we controlled it, and that was our place where we were going to do startupism in its purest form. And then hopefully, you know, that would all come together. Yeah, I didn't know how successful it would be. And from my perspective, it was mixed. How did I know it was working? At demo day, when the entire city showed up for it at Work Play, I was like, oh. Like, we were just heads down working in this room and having a nice time together. And then the community all showed up for it. And that was cool. The emails I got that night from so many important people in the community that felt like they had just witnessed something, like, congratulations, so what just happened? A thing happened. That was really gratifying. But then a few weeks later, I got a whole different batch of emails. And I think this is something that is indicative of success too, that I wouldn't have guessed at the time, which is, hey, how can I get involved? How can I attach my name to this? Oh, have you thought about doing this? Oh, maybe you should change this. Oh, I actually think you got that wrong. Like, all these folks recognized success and wanted to attach themselves to it. And that was a surprise for me. I did the entire thing for free. So I was an unpaid employee, and it's hard to boss around an unpaid employee. So when I felt like some of the wrong folks were getting involved, I ultimately didn't want to be a part of it anymore. But it lived on, and lo and behold, it played such a huge role in my career. And then Techstars came, and then you started your accelerator, and all these other things have happened. So, yeah, I'll take some credit for getting that kicked off. But it was a fascinating experience.
Yeah, I think there were two things that came out of that specifically, in addition to what you mentioned, which was there was programming that was geared towards and specific to early stage tech startups. And I don't think that really existed, not really, in the ecosystem before. So it was kind of the flag in the ground going, okay, we're going to do this thing, and this programming is going to be for these, you know, cohort companies, for these founders. And the other thing that came out of it is, I go back to Estes and Brooke and other people that got involved, and now these people are incredibly influential, important, ambitious, and talented leaders in the ecosystem in their respective organizations. We just had Brooke on the podcast last week, and it's amazing to see like how that seeded in a number of different ways. So dovetailing on the Velocity launch, you went on to launch and manage the Alabama Techstars Energy Accelerator, and it was the first and only energy accelerator in the Techstars program. As a Seattle Techstars grad yourself, how did your founder experience in that program influence your approach to the managing director role?
Yeah, it made all the difference. I was given a gift in 2010. I got to go to Seattle, and I got to, I was a very entrepreneurial person, but didn't have a language for it. I didn't know that, for instance, you might go fundraise. My only idea of a company was that you go get some customers and then you have a company. It's not a bad way to think about a company, right, by the way. But that's how I ever did. You know, I grew my first business to, you know, like approaching $1 million in recurring revenue with no funding. And that was a way to do it. And so certainly, seeing, you know, sorry, I lost my train of thought. What was the question?
Well, no, you're just talking about, how your founder experience at Techstars influenced.
Yeah. So I got to go to Seattle, and I got to hang around the true OGs in my mind. Like, who are the OGs? Like, these are the OGs. And so David Cohen, the founder of Techstars, Brad Feld, one other founder of Techstars, they were in Seattle. It was the third Techstars program. They were there the entire time. So I got to go see what it was like and see how it is done well. And so coming back here, you know, Brad was writing Startup Communities during the time, and he talked a lot about that startup founders have to go lead communities like Birmingham. And I took that to heart. And so a lot of what I saw in Seattle really lit the fire for me to come here and give back as much as I could. But I couldn't have had the run I had at Techstars here without seeing what I saw in Seattle. There's no way.
Yeah, I remember you sharing some stories with me when we first met and I got to know you a little bit. You were talking about what all you took from Seattle as a startup community, and that being kind of at least a reference point, not necessarily trying to do the things that Seattle was doing in Birmingham, but it's like, I've seen what a big tech ecosystem is doing, and that informed it. And I've heard a lot of what you said echoed by other people. Talking about, like, really focusing on talent, really focusing on developing people, really trying to get the community involved in kind of a sincere way. So it's been interesting from my perspective to watch that. And part of your journey through the ecosystem has put you in a unique position to lend some perspective. You've been doing this for, 15 years now? So in that time period, how have you seen the local ecosystem evolve, good, bad, or indifferent?
Well, if you look at an ecosystem like Birmingham, it goes through some really predictable stages. And one is, don't care about innovation, right? Like, there's nothing going on, nobody cares, not a thing. Then you go through this period where there's energy for innovation, and that's good, right? But what happens is it manifests itself in some immature and kind of bizarre ways. So I still remember a startup competition here from, I don't know, 10 or so years ago, where a company doing like really deep, like hard tech was competing against a bakery. And that's weird, right? And the bakery lost, and they did a better job on
it's
the
like,
pitch.
How do you demonstrate you're an emerging ecosystem when that's your
constituents? Right. And I think the judges were like, well, I think the market opportunity is bigger for this hard tech. It's like, no kidding. Like, that's your big insight?
You know, bread goes stale like within like 24 hours, and software not so much.
That's right. And even when I talk about some of these early velocity things, like all of that was predictable, and it's not bad. It's there's excitement toward innovation. There's people that want to be involved. You're not sure what's good and what's bad. And then you start to normalize, and you start to mature as an ecosystem. And you know, some of the things that you start to see, and there's nothing that is more important than a big exit. Like, all this work that you and I do, it's great. But generating real wealth for a community and then having that wealth recycle back in at more conventional investment terms, like, there is nothing you can do more important than that. And I think something that Birmingham really, and other cities are look up to Birmingham from a startup perspective, by the way. And so from top-level accelerators coming here to having a generally founder-led ecosystem, which I would still say we do,
yeah.
To having some real eye-popping exits that other cities would love to have, you know, Birmingham has grown up. It doesn't mean the work is done. It isn't done. And there's just like a startup, there's always more. There's always someone going bigger, doing more, raising more money, whatever. And there's always going to be cities that we look up to and we're like, why can't we be like that? But a lot of really cool things have happened here. And how we've evolved over the last 10 years is pretty extraordinary.
You talked about generating wealth. And the other thing that I've watched, especially accelerate over the last five to seven years, is the talent that is created in these companies where somebody is thrown into the deep end of the pool and they're saying, we're going to grow like crazy and you're going to be unqualified for this job and you're going to be unqualified for the projects I'm asking you to do and you're just going to have to go out and figure it out. And now when I look back at some of the people that are doing some of the best work or I think are some of the most talented people in our ecosystem, I can almost always trace them back to some period of time when they were working with a group of people like you, like Shagan, like Bill, like Tony, like Chad Troll, others, where you can literally look back and go, oh, that's where they started to pick some of the stuff up, and then they ran with it. And so not only the wealth part of it, but also too the talent creation, because we're all figuring it out. I mean, that's the big secret, right, that nobody wants to say out loud. But it's like we were all unqualified to be founders, or we were all unqualified to work for startups, and we just had to figure it out. And so it's been fun to watch that progress as well.
Yeah, there was a founder, 10 or 12 years ago, that I had a single conversation with at one of Tony Somerville's startup drinks. And he was working at a bank, and he was telling me about the startup idea. He had, and it sounded interesting. And I was like, here's an idea. Why don't you quit the bank and go do that startup?
That sounds like you.
And that was like the extent of our conversation. And so he did. And look, that is like the smallest thing you can possibly do. And I give myself practically no credit for this person's success. But they did. And they went through a top accelerator and they started a company and they raised a bunch of money. And whenever I see this founder, he was like, that was the conversation that took me over the top. And so, you know, I guess sometimes it takes a little nudge from someone that's trusted in the community to get somebody on the path. Once again, I think I deserve practically no credit for that. But in that entrepreneur's mind, like that conversation meant something, and that's pretty cool.
Well, that's something that comes up as a theme on this podcast a lot of times, which is experienced founders or experienced mentors or people that, you know, just say something kind of off the cuff. It doesn't really mean anything to them. It's like muscle memory. Just, you know, they just say it. And it has this profound impact because you don't realize they've never contemplated that before. That's never crossed their mind. It's something you do every single day, you've done for years, and it's just like, whatever. But they've never heard that before. They've never seen that before. And I also think the power of the kind of the peer base. You know, if a coworker at the bank said that, it wouldn't mean as much as Nate from InstaGift or Nate from Techstar saying this to somebody going, you need to go and do this thing. Because now all of a sudden they go, maybe I do need to do this thing. So ecosystems, good, bad, or indifferent, create what I would call unforced errors, right? We do things that are silly with unintended consequences or just not enough forethought or foresight to see, hey, we're about to do something that doesn't make a lot of sense. And when I say ecosystem, I don't just mean Birmingham. I mean the state. I mean the Southeast. I mean the country in general. And I do think it's important to call balls and strikes. We want to do it professionally, all of those things, but it is important to talk about those things and not shy away from them, because I do think in examining where we've let ourselves down is where we grow. So if you look at that, what kinds of unforced errors do you think we've committed in our own ecosystems?
You know, to get back to the spectrum of don't care about innovation to a mature ecosystem, you know, that middle portion always comes with a lot of unforced errors. And I guess the way that I would look at it would be those have to happen to get to where you're going to go. So I'm very forward thinking. I don't dwell on the past a lot. You know, I've pointed out some of those unforced errors. Too many cooks in the kitchen when you start to see success and not letting someone run with an idea. A bakery competing against a hard tech company at a startup competition. But all of that is with good intent. So as long as there's good intent behind these mistakes, like, great. That's what startups do, by the way. We go start companies, we're going to make a ton of mistakes. So I don't put a lot of stock in that. But here is, when I see the word unforced errors in Alabama, my brain only goes one place. And that is to our government. And nothing has been more, lately, more impactful and more of an unforced error than some of the fertility stuff that's happened here. You know, my wife and I, sorry, I'm off tracking us a little bit, but if you want to talk about unforced errors, let's talk about them. My wife and I have three kids. We have twin 12-year-olds, and that was a product of the fertility system here in Alabama. If we couldn't have get the care that we needed, 12, 15 years ago, we would have left. We just would have left. And we wouldn't have thought twice about it. And if we would have left then, who is leaving now? And more than that, why Alabama has to be the testing ground for every, the furthest out crazy social ideas that are out there is an unforced error. It impacts our economy. It impacts the ability for founders to come here and want to come here. And something that has changed over the last, decade that's been profound for me is I've been recruiting founders to Alabama for a decade. And I'm proud of that. And I have some real success stories of people that have moved here through work that I've done. Who isn't moving here right now? Can I, as someone that recruits people here with a straight face, tell founders to come here, that there is something for them in Alabama? Because that's the argument that I'm making.
Right.
It's been really cool to see how the mindset set has shifted over the last decade of people like, oh yeah, I hear great things about Birmingham. And that's been cool to be a part of. But right now, we are shooting ourselves in the foot by some of the policies that are happening that make people not want to be here. And that, to me, is the greatest unforced error of all.
Yeah, and I want to underscore that point that what frustrates me is when you get into some of the regulations, some of the legal action, some of the legislation that's taken place in the state, what I don't hear people talk about is, hey, this is de facto economic policy, right? That that this thing that we're doing or pushing or reinforcing or legislating or codifying into law is going to have some people look at this state and go, nope, that's probably not for me, right? And when you start talking about things like reproductive rights, you're talking about 50% of the population that's going to have a very visceral and understandably visceral reaction to those policies. And what I get frustrated about and what I keep trying to push people to do is like, you have to understand the downstream effect from an economic development, from an economic policy standpoint, which is you're not going to get the opportunity to recruit new companies, new talent, younger talent. Let's just call it like it is. There is a very different ideology among technology companies and technology founders than industrialists. That's just a fact. However we want to slice that cake, that's just the way it is. And so I get frustrated equally with some of those things, but most specifically, why are we not talking about the impact that this is going to have on kind of dollars and cents?
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And we have to ask ourselves, who do we want here in our state? And I had the great pleasure of getting to run the TechStars Alabama Energy Tech Sustainability Climate Accelerator. And I will never be more thankful to Alabama Power for supporting that the way that they did. They were one of the best corporate partners, if not the best corporate partner at TechStars. But be clear what happened. Like, we were running an accelerator that was taking on climate tech, that was taking on great, big problems. And we can't have an accelerator taking on climate tech 1 minute while at the state level we're denying that climate change exists at the next minute. And that is just another example. But I mean, I was recruiting kids from California saying, you need to move to Alabama because that's where climate tech is happening.
Yeah.
And that is extraordinary to get to be a part of that. But I don't know if I could, if I was running Techstars right now, I don't know how I would feel about recruiting. I wouldn't be able to recruit people here the same way that I was doing before, with the same like full-throated endorsement of this place. We have some real challenges right now as a state, and it impacts who's coming here.
Yeah, make no mistake, it's a conversation that has to happen. Anything around recruiting or relocating to the state, especially within kind of technology companies, it's a conversation that we have to have. And we're very honest and we're very forthright about it. And people have to make the decisions that are right for them and their families. But yeah, it's absolutely a factor. And I think maybe the very definition of an unforced error, at least from the economic impact side. So awful segue to this next question, but maybe getting into lighter subject material, if nothing else. You hold the record for the most half-court basketball shots made in 1 hour. Did I get that correctly?
No.
Oh, geez. All right, correct me. You hold a world record in something around half-court shots.
Yeah, so I... When I finished up my time at Velocity, I also had just exited a company. It was called PrepTix, and it was in the high school event ticketing space. We sold it to private equity. If you've gone to a high school event and used GoFan, that's who bought us.
Yeah.
And so we built the original iteration of that company and sold it to private equity. So I had some time on my hands. I'm a huge basketball fan, and I went on to Reddit, and there was a post that went to the top of Reddit in the NBA offseason that said, if you're locked alone in a gym... and you have to hit 400 NBA, so like really far away three-pointers to escape, to unlock the doors, would you live or die? And the number one comment was, I would airball the first shot, huddle up in the middle of the court, and just wait for death. And so like a true entrepreneur, like I went to Best Buy, and I got a GoPro, and I recreated the conditions perfectly, and I made 400 out of 803 three-pointers.
Okay.
And I posted online, it legitimately went viral. It went to the very top of all of Reddit. And hundreds of thousands of people saw it. And then people all over the world tried to break the record. And then I spent over a year trying to get my record back. And I learned that you don't just get to decide you're the best basketball shooter in the world, that actually talent plays a role. And so I didn't get my record back. So like a good entrepreneur, I changed the rules. I recreated the challenge as a 100, you had to make 100 half-court shots before the doors unlock. And I made 100 out of 600. And ESPN then, I posted on social media, and everybody thought it was funny.
Hold on. Time out for a second. Yeah. What is the percentage of make at 100 for 600 attempts?
Well, 1 out of 6, 16%. I made 4 in a row at my peak.
That's kind of an unbelievably high percentage in my mind. I'm not a huge basketball guy, but 16% from half court seems awfully good.
As it turns out, I think it's more of a... it's something that is just stupid and no one should try doing that. It's an endurance feat more than it is like you're really great at shooting.
Well, because you were rebounding your own shots, right? You didn't have anybody helping you. No. Nobody was feeding you the rock, nothing. You had to do all of that.
That's right. And so I posted about it, an ESPN call, and they're like, oh my gosh, can we put this on the Jump, which is their number one basketball show on like ESPN proper. And I was like, yeah, are you kidding me? I'd love for this to be on the Jump. And so what it was is at the end of the Jump, like the special interest story they do, like idiot middle-aged Alabama man claims to have set the world record in half-court shots. But Rachel Nichols, who was a good announcer for ESPN at the time, said, you know, I bet LeBron could do this. And so I can say with a straight face that I have been compared to LeBron James on ESPN. Like that's a fact. And when I tell people that, they don't know if it's a joke. Sometimes I'll give people that cold. Like, hey, tell me about yourself. Yeah, I was compared to LeBron on ESPN. And people be like, uh-huh. And they don't like...
It doesn't register?
Well,
like,
what's the
they don't question it?
What's the punchline?
Like this, they're waiting for the rest of the story.
Yeah, where's the rest of the story? I'm like,
I'm done. I'm done with the story.
That's what happened. I was on ESPN and they compared me to LeBron.
Did LeBron ever attempt it?
No, he has other things he's working on.
He was kind of otherwise employed.
Yeah,
right.
He hasn't been emailing.
Anything. So, do you like? Are you registered with Guinness or any like other than the video evidence that you filmed yourself?
No, it's self-declared.
Because I looked up...
And no one else has beaten it.
And part of the reason why I screwed this up was the only... When I went and I did research on this, because I remembered most of it. I'm glad to remember that I didn't make up the half court stuff. I remember the 3-point stuff, but I for some reason I was fascinated with the half court. But I went to do research on it and I was like, there's nothing in Guinness. There's nothing in like these things. And like, it would take me back to like a year old Twitter account, which I don't think you've tweeted from in years. But anyway, so it was fun to watch. So the question I have for you is you look back at that. Is that not one of those things that you're going to always point to and go, man, I am so glad I did that. It was so ridiculous and so epically like fulfilling at the same time.
Yeah, I would say the way I'm wired is take a ridiculous thing and play it out to a conclusion that very few people would play it out to. And look, that serves itself in entrepreneurship. Yeah. It serves it. It just, you know, just gives my brain something to obsess. It goes back to mental health. You know, when I speak about founder mental health, I still go shoot. I've shot tens and tens of thousands of shots, mostly 3-pointers. A good workout for me is I'll make 100 3-pointers out of 120.
So, jeez.
So 80% is a nice workout for me, and I just feel better when I do it. So yeah, it was fun.
That's pretty cool. Nate, thanks so much for being on the show. Appreciate you coming out.